Well, good morning, Mr. Secretary. Thank you for coming by this morning. And we appreciate you having made the offer to come and talk with us on an informal basis at the front end of our work. I think what we'd like to do here, I know that you are on a tight schedule, as always, your helicopter awaits, right? is I don't know how long you plan to, you know, speak to us in terms of opening remarks, but we'd love to have as much time for questioning as possible, but love to hear your overview of, as we talked about, your perspective on the crisis and how we ought to view things.
So you'd like me to start?
Sure.
Okay. So I'll do, 8 minutes. Is that okay? I'll do it real quick. I'll do it as briskly as possible.
You can go to 9.
You guys? And you, if you interrupt me, you can stop me anytime. You can do any details on it. And thanks
We can't shout you why, though, right? Just to get it clear.
No, you can do it.
It's fine.
Okay. So you guys have a list. I saw some list you guys represented that had 21 causes.
22.
Right? 22. Those are a pretty good list. I want to give you my hierarchy of what I think was most consequential. I'm not claiming perfect foresight. I'm not claiming unique wisdom. Obviously, I've got biases just because I'm a prisoner of my past, like everybody else. But I think it's important to for you to hear that from me, because you can view everything I say after this when I get to do this more formally with you guys through this prism. Okay. So I think my list has 8 or something like that, or 7. So I'll go through them kind of quickly. I think you have to start with a basic recognition, and this is true for, in some ways, all financial crises, is that you had this long period of relative stability, no history of significant falls in house prices, the memory of large recessions, deep recessions, crises had basically faded, and people everywhere just made a huge amount of consequential judgments on the expectation that the future would be as stable. Economists are talking about a great moderation. All our period, you know, we had crises every 5 years in the United States, but they seemed pretty manageable, small. People thought it was really the end of history, you know, the end of this stuff. That's very consequential. So a lot of the mistakes in ratings, in risk management, people deciding they're going to borrow a huge amount on the expectation earnings are going to rise further was based on that fundamental premise. Second, not different, though, is the basic monetary policy global imbalance thing. So monetary policy around the world was too loose, too long. Real rates were very low for a very long period of time. You had this huge increase in wealth in emerging world looking for some place to invest. And the fact that a huge part of the world was shadowing the dollar, fixed to the basically running a peg against the dollar, and they were leaning against the appreciation pressures in their currency, meant they were accumulating U.S. assets that pushed U.S. interest rates down as the Fed tightened. That made the bubble in real estate much greater, much larger. This was not... People want to say this is a Greenspan monetary policy error. It's much more complicated than that. Because, again, as the Fed tightened, a whole bunch of other things pushed U.S. long rates down. That had a big impact on borrowing, on leverage, and lending, asset price bubbles. Important. Third thing. The simplest way to think about regulatory failure in the United States is, I think, through the following prism. We had a banking system grow up in the shadow of the real banking system that was huge in scale. So the parallel banking system, shadow banking is not the right word because it was all in the public eye, but the size of banks, entities doing banking, borrowing and lending, affected banking functions, no different from a classic bank, grew up alongside the banking system, funded very short, very vulnerable to runs, huge amount of leverage, much more leverage than in banks, terribly vulnerable to panics. Now, and this basically is the unifying theme for the investment banks, for AIG, to some extent for the guys who were sort of operating as quasi-thrift finance companies. Countrywide is the best example. Again, they were basically banks run with huge amount of leverage, liquidity risk. And when the world turned and people were unwilling to fund these guys, they came crashing down, putting a huge amount of pressure on the rest of the system. Now, banks were... I'm coming to banks, because banks weren't like innocent victims of this at all. But important to recognize that, because what we allowed in our system was risk to basically shift outside the banking system to a bunch of entities that were doing banking, and that got to be on a massive scale. Now, you can look at all sorts of measures of that, but it was very, very large relative to the size of the banking system. I'm going to go a little more briskly.
You're doing fine.
There's a whole set of things that are about incentives, which you guys will be excellent at going through, but it's very important to recognize that the incentives and the compensation structure, what the tax regime did to incentives to borrow, what the accounting system did for how you captured or did not capture obligations, other forms of regulatory arbitrage that were permitted or incented were hugely important to this. Moral hazard. Moral hazard is everywhere in financial systems. It's endemic. Of course, what we had to do in the crisis makes it a bunch worse going forward. Biggest source of moral hazard was in the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie. It was GSEs were entirely moral hazard. It's harder to find in the rest of the system, just even looking back over time. Very hard to imagine anybody in the world said, I was funding Lehman Brothers at that level because of the expectation the government would come in and save Lehman from its sins. I don't think you can find any rational investor would have really, any sort of honest investor would have said that. You had a bunch of people, again, arbitrage the safety net, affiliate with banks or thrifts, get some funding advantage from that. So there's a more moral hazard in the system, but it was overwhelming in the GSEs, but not just about the GSEs. I think regulations and enforcement, I think it's just fair to say the mood of the time was a deep skepticism about the value of supervision and enforcement. And I don't think it was aggressive enough. I have some experience with this. Just remember, the conventional wisdom of our time, just if you go back 2 years ago, was that, we had erred too far in the other direction, that the rules were excessive and competition among enforcement authorities in the wake of Spitzer et al. Had gone too far. And the biggest threat to the vibrancy of our financial system was basically we were doing too much aggression on the enforcement side. I think the opposite was true. And there was just a deep skepticism about the bad value of this stuff, and people were not aggressive enough in using the authorities. You guys, the best examples of this, of course, their examples are legion, but best example, I think, is this. Just look at the way supervisory guidance is done. Supervisory guidance on subprime issued by the Fed did not come out until the peak had passed on subprime issuance. If you look back at supervisory guidance issued the previous two decades, similar pattern. It doesn't come until the peak has passed. It's very late. Now, that you can't prevent that completely because people don't have perfect foresight. People won't be preemptive in this stuff. But you want supervisors caught trying, not waiting until the damage is so acute you have no choice but to act. Final point, which is not so much about the cause of the underlying vulnerability in the system, but mostly about why the crisis got so bad is, we came into this crisis, United States of America, with deeply adequate tools for containing the damage. There are two, to make it simple, there are two types of tools that we did not have as a country. One is for managing failure of large complex institutions. We had it for banks and thrifts, but did not have it. Secretary of the Treasury at that time, to his enormous credit, proposed legislation in the immediate aftermath of Bear Stearns to remedy that problem. Still don't have it today, although we're hoping to get it today soon. And it's a bankruptcy doesn't work for financial institutions. It's a complicated question, but I'm sure that's right. And lacking that authority made the crisis much more damaging than it should have been. Other thing is the authority to contain financial panics. This was a classic financial panic. Crises that involve, like, the failure of a couple firms because of just mismanagement are not hard to deal with. But broad-based financial panics, 100-year floods, are very difficult to deal with. We learned this lesson, you know, with deep scars in the late 19th century, early 20th century. Put in place a lot of protections around that at that time, around the banking system. But because we allowed this enormous banking system to grow up outside the banking system itself, with no tools to contain panics there, it was much more damaging than it should have been. Keith will remember this. Remarkable thing. Only executive powers of the President of the United States in financial emergencies coming into this crisis were to declare a national bank holiday and close markets. Not a credible way, tenable way to run a country. Particularly for the United States of America, the reserve currency of the world, and our banks, our institutions playing such an enormous role in confidence globally. And, of course, you've got to worry about that balance. We're trying to figure out a way to make sure we can kill institutions safely and contain panics more effectively without adding to moral hazard. As you wrote today, Peter, terribly difficult thing to do. But you cannot say credibly that you're going to prevent future crises by abolishing the fire station and promising you'll never act. It doesn't work as a basic strategy. We had a good experience of that as a country. Naturally, we had to run a basic test of that proposition last year. Didn't turn out so well for the country. Caused enormous damage. Getting it better balanced is hard to do. But you can't wish away the basic problem and assume that fires are caused by the fire station and the United States of America can, you know, protect the system in the future by hoping that guys don't make mistakes again on a massive scale. That's my list.
Terrific. Let's do this then. Let's start with John and go around this way, and we'll keep going until the Secretary's got to go. We'll just keep going around the horn.
Well, like all of these things, there are early signs that got ignored, that had we acted upon some of those early signals, perhaps we could have mitigated the impact somewhat. So what would, in your mind, have been the first two or three things that, had we acted upon, we might have dampened the impact of this?
Well, I think, again, the overwhelmingly big things were the huge growth in borrowing by the U.S. household sector, huge rise in credit growth for the U.S. economy relative to the size of our economy, and the amount of that risk that ended up in this shadow banking system, parallel banking system. Now, those are people, it's not people unaware of those at the time. They were looking at them all, but if it's to happen in booms, they rationalize them as being a sign of structural changes that are healthy and good, and I would say those are the most serious ones. Now, of course, there's a bunch of others. Again, if you look at just what happened to underwriting standards, you look at basic practices in consumer credit and mortgages, and you watch the great thing to look at is what happened: the share of consumer credit that was underwritten by banks versus non-banks. And you watch over time, banks were 80%, that became 50%. Because again, what happened is
that consumer credit?
Yeah, just I think, I'm not sure if it's a mortgage or a consumer or both or and, but it just moved outside the banking system.
With the tax structure, starts mortgage, winds up personal interest, the way you can play the game.
Exactly. So. And people refinance all their consumer debt, their credit card debt, with mortgages when their house price is, made that possible. But that was a rational financial strategy. But overall borrowing went up very substantially over that period of time.
Okay. Gershley.
Mr. Secretary, you talked about the regulatory gap that was created by failure to supervise the shadow banking institutions. Do you think that the regulatory gap in no government oversight of the OTC derivatives market played a role?
The way I should have said it a little slightly differently, I think there are these two gaps in the system. One is around institutions, like AIG, major investment banks, the countrywide of the world. The other was around what you might call markets. And the way the derivative market evolved and the way the secured lending, securities lending, tri-party repo markets evolved, you had a system where contagion was going to spread much more broadly when institutions were at risk. And derivatives were part of that because, as you know, because the stuff wasn't centrally cleared and all the risk was bilateral, and people had thousands of counterparties and tens of thousands of positions and huge gross notionals, they didn't really understand directly what their exposure would be in the event of default of a major institution. And that caused a much more brutal pullback in risk than you would normally have had, even in an acute panic. And that fed on itself, caused the classic margin spiral, the leveraging spiral. So I think that was part of it. But it's not for the reason many people talk about, because, in fact, the direct exposure these firms had in their derivative positions, their exposure to hedge funds, was pretty modest relative to capital. They actually managed their overall exposure relatively carefully relative to capital. There was just panic-inducing behavior from the way the weakness spread across the system, both through the funding mechanism and, to some extent, through the derivatives markets.
Largely because of lack of transparency.
I think part of it's that, but again, you know, in derivatives, if the monoline insurance companies and AIG were not able to write huge amounts of protection with no capital to back it up. When I said about capital, it meant among the regulated intermediaries. If they had not been able to write those commitments, it would have been a much less serious crisis. And that's just a more simple thing. It's not about derivatives so much as being no capital to back a commitment. It doesn't need it's not about a fancy product or even so much an oversight of derivatives. It's just that the regulatory authorities responsible for those institutions did not force them to hold capital against their commitments. Just like the regulatory authority of GSEs didn't force them to hold capital against their obligations.
All right. Keith.
The stress tests, they worked. I've heard two explanations as to why. One is that the common informational base provided investors with the information they needed to invest. And the other is that if you were one of the, was it 20 or 21 who got money last fall? And if you were one of the 21 who were part of the stress test, you now have an implicit guarantee. How do we distinguish between the two reasons for why?
I think my own view is almost overwhelmingly the former, and the best test of that is the following. If it had been the latter, it was just a sense of the basic guarantee to hold the system together, which we worked very hard to foster because we thought that was going to be least cost ultimately and more effective. You would not have had these guys be able to raise capital on the scale they did, private capital, because the investors would have been living as they were last year with the fear of progressive further dilution, and they would have been unwilling to put the capital in because they would have known that there's some risk ahead still. Losses would still grow relative to capital, and they'd be diluted again. So my view is if what had happened is that it was all just about the implicit commitment or the explicit commitment to hold the system together, then you wouldn't have needed, these guys wouldn't have been able to raise capital, wouldn't have needed to raise capital. So that's my argument. I can't know for sure. But I have a slightly different explanation than when you started with. I think it was a combination of the fact that we basically effectively committed to put a floor under an economy that was falling off the cliff and to hold the system together. We provided catastrophic insurance, which governments have to do. That's what we exist to do. The Fed took a huge step to do that over the course of the fall. It was incomplete. That was very helpful. That combined with forcing the disclosure and forcing them to go raise private capital to cover the hole created by the disclosure, I think was what made it work.
Heather?
Thanks. You had mentioned incentives and compensation and performance as one of the contributing factors, and I know there's been a pretty robust discussion around CEO compensation. Do you think we should be having the same discussion about the regulators and the supervisors and how they are measured for their performance?
I think something is wrong in the basic craft of supervision in the United States, but I don't think it's because of the classic forms of regulatory capture, what I must call regulatory capture, in the sense the protections that exist on against that, post-employment restrictions, a range of other things like that, are pretty good. Now, they're not paid very much. They don't get much training. They don't spend any time in the market. They've got a much less sophisticated understanding of the institutions they're supposed to supervise than they would need to do it effectively. And so I think you need to need a long effort to try to improve the basic craft of supervision. It was allowed to erode over time. The issue I began with, which is a long period of relative stability without crises, does tend to erode the quality of supervision because you're not used to fighting wars. And but I think, you know, we're doing a study of supervision, and as part of that study, we're forcing the supervisors to take a broad, comprehensive look and report and disclose what their procedures are for managing conflict, post-employment restrictions, the ethical restrictions on investment, all those kind of things are, so people can look at it and see the common basis, see if they're tough enough. So I think something's, it's obvious, it's like not strong enough, not good enough, but I think it's probably not about the, you know, those classic forms of conflict. If you let firms choose their regulator, okay, if you let them flip their charter from a Fed-supervised bank to a OTS-supervised thrift, if you let them shift the type of the form of the instrument they're creating for their client to take advantage of a lower tax treatment or a more effective regulatory capital treatment or a lower jurisdiction, then you undermine all the basic protections that supervisors are supposed to defend and protect. And it's very hard for them to lean against that basic structure. If you know, again, if you fund your supervisors with fees on the institutions, and the institutions can choose who their supervisor is, it's not a stable dynamic. So I think those things would likely be more powerful. But I would be, nothing would make me happier than to have a bunch of generals come in and figure out how to improve the basic craft of supervision and make it tougher again.
All right. Thank you. Monetary policy. So what's changed today if, in fact, you know, if in fact we were awash in money, too much liquidity, emerging markets, investing in our economies, I assume that it means that when those periods occur, we have to have extraordinary vigilance. But what's changed in that? What's changed in that underlying equation today?
I mean, have we figured out how to avoid this problem from repeating?
Yeah, given that it's, in your mind, it's one of the driving forces.
Well, I think that
not to say it can't be mitigated, but it is a driving force.
I think that there are sort of three things that have to happen in parallel. One is I know you're going to talk to the chairman, but I think among central banks, having been a central banker, they're going to have to, the basic doctrine of central banking is going to change, and people are going to recognize that you can't just focus on what's happening in consumer prices and consumer price expectations. You have to look at broader measures of asset prices and credit. Easy to say that, but it means that policy, I think, will move to a more pragmatic approach, and maybe that'll leave you a little more preemption when you don't see in inflation signs of big, huge distortions, but you see them in other things. Second thing is you need to, you know, the global, what the economists call the global monetary system, which is the exchange rate policies of the rest of the world, are going to have to change, and they're changing quite dramatically. All basically, everybody that matters in the world now is pretty close to floating against us. Not floating fully, freely floating, but allow much more flexibility in their currencies against us. Two big exceptions that are on a meaningful scale. One are China. One is China, of course, and that's going to have to change. And the other is the large part of the Gulf economies, major oil exporters, basically run a peg against the dollar. Those are a little more unique and special. Those may be sustainable. But for the vast part of the more rapidly growing emerging world that's been shadowing the dollar, you've had the necessary condition, not sufficient condition for the change, which is most of them move to much more flexible currencies already. And China's left increasingly isolated, hard for them to be as flexible as they need to be with China following the dollar where it is. So that's going to have to change. The last thing is just on the, as I said, on the regulatory framework. You know, you need to have tougher capital standards applied more broadly across the system, and that'll make that'll mean you'll have future booms in credit, future booms in real estate, but you need to make them less damaging to the system. And the only way to do that, I think, really is to make sure that the system runs with less leverage and less liquidity risk, less panic, less run risk.
All right, Bill?
I've had and will have a lot of conversations with my former colleagues and still friends. Very hard for some of them to be in a room and have someone come in the room and say, you have to do what's on this sheet of paper or the world as you know it will end. And so the question is, yes, I think you can make that case on a couple of obvious ones. And you can completely choose not to do this now because it's really still developing. But the CIT situation, as you go down the list of those that we have to save, I don't like too big to fail, consequences of not saving them, are we really looking at the CIT situation as a 51-49 near the bottom, and it probably should have been a 49-51? Because I can't.
You've seen CIT back in the fall, or CIT in the summer?
Even back in the fall, if you look at the business model, it was so dependent upon other things happening, and I don't see the world ending like some others. So how do you wind up making that decision? Of course, in hindsight, there are a lot of easy answers. I'm trying to explain to them at the time when these guys come to you
right.
and say, we've
right.
got to do all of this.
Right. Well, the basic judgment made by the Secretary in the fall, which I completely supported, was to make sure that you put a lot of capital into the system quickly on a very broad scale, and that, you know, crisis management is about a kind of terrible choice, Bill, as you know, which is to say, which mistake, you're going to make mistakes in either direction. Which mistake is easier to correct for over time? Which mistake causes less damage? You're making choices in the fog of ignorance and uncertainty. You have to choose. You can't just sit there and say, gee, it seems kind of hard. And I think that at that time, given the scale of the panic, and the amount of damage it had already done and was still doing, because the momentum was overwhelming, was to decide you were going to err on the side of holding the system together. When we decided to push capital into the major institutions, and not just guarantee them, but push capital in, we decided that, you know, we're the United States, we've got 9,000 banks. You have to make capital available on similar terms to institutions that meet some minimal test of viability. And the system that the Secretary put in place and the chairman put in place was to let the supervisors make the judgment, you know, and who was on the right side of a line about basic viability. Now, that line was moving. So
the longer you waited, right, the fewer you had.
But I did not. I was not prepared to put more money in CIT this summer. I didn't think it was necessary. The system was stable enough we could handle it. And I'm not sure that judgment was right. Because it does cause, you know, the market doesn't move very quickly in a recession this bad to take up the lost credit capacity of CIT. CIT was a very dominant lender to parts of the small business community. So I'm not sure that was the right decision to do it. But, and I'm not saying, it doesn't mean it was the wrong decision to do in the fall. It's just that at that point, I think, we had to make a choice given the stakes there, given the degree of damage caused by the panic, to err on the side of trying to hold the system together. So there's a firmer foundation. We stopped the free fall in activity. We've taken out the acute fear of deflation, financial collapse, global depression. And once you had that foundation laid in place, you had a little more flexibility to let the rest of the system go. Now, I think most. We allowed a lot of trauma and a lot of failure in our system, not just running up until the fall of last year, but even after that. And we, you know, our financial system is smaller today. It's much less leveraged. The weakest parts of the system have gone away. They don't really exist in a fundamental sense. And that's a great strength of our system. It's not so fun to live with. It caused a lot of damage. But, you know, we were up here.
We had to heal faster.
You can heal faster if you did, I agree. We were here. We needed to get to here. We just didn't want to get there by going like this. Mm-hmm. So we weren't trying to hold it up here, sustain up here. We were just trying to make sure that that adjustment happened with less risk of catastrophic collateral damage to the innocent. And I don't think we got that judgment right until starting last fall.
Senator?
First, thank you very much for this time. Last night, we had an interesting discussion, among other things, about the PCORA Commission and what left is to be learned. One of the things that David Moss said was not covered by the PCORA Commission was an evaluation of the effectiveness of government actions during the
crisis
of the early 30s. So I'd like to ask some questions about what metrics you would suggest we should use if we choose to evaluate the effectiveness of government action. And I'd like to ask if you can apply those metrics, particularly in what's become one of the most sensitive aspects of this crisis, and that is employment. Decisions made before the crisis, during, and as it runs through, how should we evaluate the government decisions specifically as they have affected jobs?
That's a complicated question, of course, is that you can't look back and do justice to choice because you don't know what would have happened in the absence of the actions. You know all that. My own views on this are, you know, this was a classic financial crisis combined with a recession. The severity of both made the whole outcomes much worse. In that context, almost all economists would say you can't solve it just with monetary policy. Because of the weakness of the financial system, you have to have very, very substantial support through fiscal policy, taxes, and investments. There's no way out of it without that. It has to come alongside monetary policy. And of course, you got to make sure there's capital in the financial system and you contain the panic. Because it was hard to know how bad this was going to be, overwhelmingly the major burden for the first stage of the crisis was on monetary policy and the Fed. It was never going to solve it. Fiscal policy moved, again, much to Paulson's credit, but didn't come early enough, forceful enough, or well-designed enough, and it wasn't done on a globally coordinated basis until the very late last year. That meant all the things we did fiscally leaked, and it made them much less powerful. And of course, as you heard me say, I think we escalated late on the contain the panic front. Now, the unemployment question is much harder. I think that, as Bill said, that you know the way our economy works, and it's completely different from what you're seeing in Europe, where unemployment has not risen very much, but productivity growth has basically gone flat or negative. In our system, we see the opposite response, which is that you see a very, very deep initial cuts in employment. You see a lot of failure happen across the system. Productivity growth rates went up incredibly rapidly. You could say that's positive for how quickly we come out of this. Most of America doesn't think it's so terrific. Very hard to sustain. That's the basic choice that the structure of our economy produces. And because we don't run a system where we force job sharing and we constrain the ability of companies to fire, that's the kind of outcome we get. Now, as you know, the big error that lots of economists made was in not seeing how bad unemployment would get, even if growth recovered. Growth's actually doing better than what the consensus was. Bottomed earlier, probably come back a little stronger than the consensus earlier in the year. Unemployment much, much worse because of that. And I think that's because people underestimated the extent to which you'd see businesses do the short-term brutal thing rather than retaining their employment base And the question is, was that avoidable? Would it have been possible to avoid that rise in unemployment? And I don't know. I just don't know. And right now, of course, we're debating whether we have how much latitude we have to bring it down more rapidly than it can come down. But when you have you've got a long period where huge parts of the American economy, consumers borrowed a huge amount of income, and savings went negative for a period of time. That's going to produce a long period of adjustment to that, which is necessary, unavoidable, fundamentally healthy. But that to itself is going to make growth slower and make unemployment higher longer. And I don't know. You cannot push money into the system now as a way to solve that problem. I mean, it's not a problem you can solve by having in a responsible way, with deficits of 10% of GDP now, by trying to directly just hire a bunch of people, write a bunch of checks. It's just not something you can do. You have limited scope to do that now, which is a tragic thing, but it's a constraint produced by reality.
Could I just sharpen his question? Just
sure, and then I'll
really quick
just want to make sure we get around before.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that a lot of the problem was in the home building and the mortgage area, and that there are an awful lot of jobs there? And to a very great extent, this is probably one of the bigger gray areas of our economy in counting who's working and who's not, notwithstanding
construction's
the
much more employment intensive.
Goes through the system.
Yeah, construction much more employment intensive than manufacturing, not quite as much as services, of course.
No.
But and so if you have the correction after a long period of overbuilding, it's going to make unemployment rise.
And it's not going to come back.
Rise more, and it'll take some of that won't come back.
Okay. Byron, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I wondered if you might identify what you consider some of the most serious unintended consequences of the actions of the Treasury and the Fed to resolve the crisis, in particular, whether you think the consolidation of power in a few institutions that are left standing and would provide extraordinary assistance creates a systemic risk that we need to worry about going forward.
I think you got the question right. I don't actually think that our system is looking too concentrated now. And I think the hard thing is about the riskiness of the institution, and risk can damage the economy is not really centrally a function of size. Again, just look at Bear Stearns and Lehman and Countrywide. They were small institutions. The big challenge is what we've done to future expectations about government support when it gets ugly, which is about moral hazard. And that's why the big test of policy is still to come in some sense, which is how effective are we going to be to put in place a set of reforms that walk back some of that moral hazard. And that's the debate we're all living with now. And you could say there's three ways you judge policy response to a crisis. One is, how much avoidable damage do you allow to happen or prevent to the innocent, to the basic fabric of the economy, survival, businesses, institutions? How expensive it is, how much do the taxpayers ultimately have to pay for cleaning up the mess? And the third check is, how effective are you at walking back the huge distortions created by the interventions to contain the fire? And that's about new rules. We have a test of that to come, but you got the right question. It's important to remember that our entire banking system today, even with the investment banks now called bank holding companies, is one times GDP. It's five times GDP in the UK, eight times in Switzerland, three to five times or two to three times in continental Europe. We were actually quite good at containing overall leverage in the banking system relative to those economies. So losses for us are going to be a much smaller fraction of GDP,
probably less explicit cost to the taxpayer on a significant scale than was true elsewhere, which is promising. But the big test, again, is how effective we are in changing the rules to dial back the moral hazard created by these actions.
All right, Douglas.
I'll go back to the beginning, and particularly the GSEs, where the clear moral hazard, I think even noted at the time, but what I'm curious about is your view on the degree to which them having a dominant position because of the policy function and their big portfolios.
In the past,
right. And going in, how much they contribute to the lowering of origination standards and what it is, and their role in the precipitation of this crisis.
See, I don't really think that that's a big part of the story, but I'm not sure. If you look at the quality of their basic assets that they in their guaranteed portfolio, it's very good, much better than banks. Their retained portfolio, they bought a bunch of stuff, partly because they were pushed by Congress to buy a bunch of stuff that may have facilitated. That was a big portfolio, non-trivial, may have facilitated that, but I think if you look at the scale, I have to go back and look. If you look at the scale of that stuff that was originated in the United States and where that ended up, a lot of it ended up in German banks and in the special vehicles, a bunch of European banks. And a bunch of that ended up much more diffused around the world. Would that have been possible without GSEs there buying some of that stuff? I don't know if it's possible. That's a good question. I haven't looked at the relative magnitude of it.
Peter.
I'm tempted to ask you where we agree, but I won't. Not now.
Okay, that's your question. That's your question.
He was tempted.
No, he asked.
Resisting
it.
The temptation. I put it that way.
He's resisting the temptation.
Here's my question. That is, it's really a two-part question. Why did you rescue Bear Stearns and not Lehman? And why did you allow Lehman to fail and then rescue AIG?
Okay, simple. This is something that that Secretary Paulson Bernanke have talked about extensively, as have I. It's a simple but not accepted argument. The fact you're asking it today still shows just how little basic acceptance of the basic argument.
I'd just like to get it on the record.
Right. Well, all the time, I'm sure I'll just do it on the record. So let me give you my perspective on this. Fed does not have the authority to put capital institutions. Fed's authority is very limited. You can lend against collateral. If it's unique and exigent, and the responsible Reserve Bank, in this case it was me, agreed that I had an adequate collateral. In the Bear Stearns case, Bear Stearns is absolutely systemic. It was like, stage one of the panic. But it was like overwhelmingly powerful panic at that point. Because we had a willing buyer who could basically take over the firm and assume liability of the firm, with us lending a modest amount against actually pretty good collateral, we had a solution to avoid a catastrophic default. Lehman was completely different. Different for two reasons. One is the scale of the financial panic globally was much more powerful at that point. Every other institution was weaker. There was no willing buyer large enough, really, to take over the vast bulk of the obligations of the firm. B of A and Barclays, good examples. They were the ones who came closest. They were not willing in the end, partly because they weren't strong enough to do it. And that left a hole in Lehman's, and the hole in Lehman's balance sheet was much, much bigger than Bear Stearns. Fed could not fill that hole by putting capital in, and could not responsibly guarantee the liability. We didn't have legal authority to guarantee the liability of the firm. We were not willing to lend into a run. Just like we weren't in the Bear Stearns case, lend into a run. We lent for 24 hours in the Bear Stearns case, really, just to get them to the point where they could buy or fire. AIG, inconceivable to me, going on the weekend, that we should or could do anything about AIG. I was completely against it. Thought it would be a mistake, not necessary. But I thought about it a lot. I spent a lot of time over that weekend when we were doing this looking at the way the insolvency regime would work for a global insurance company and looking very, very careful at the alternatives and what their basic balance sheet looked like. And I think there were three things that were sort of clear in the end. One was that it would be a terrible mess, much worse than Lehman. Because they had Lehman-type risk for the entire system. but they also were an insurance company. They'd written a huge amount of contracts. You would have had classic retail insurance panic that would have, in our judgment, that made it much worse. So it was, I learned something about it over the weekend. Interesting. The insolvency regime had no capacity of managing it. It would have been just a terrible nightmare. Remember, it's, you know, 80 countries, 50 states, not designed for this. We spent a bunch of time with the insurance people, the experts about how this thing worked. It was terrible, terrible mess. Can't be sure, but that was our basic presumption. Third thing was, in the eyes of many people, their underlying insurance companies, which were generating a lot of earnings over time, were made the whole company basically probably conditionally solvent if they could be funded. So we could make the argument, legal argument, that we had the ability as a central bank because we were lending against collateral. Congress had authorized that in 1930, or 19 whatever, when they did that. And as long as there was enough collateral to lend against, we had real companies operating businesses that were generating a huge amount of earnings over time, huge market share. Lehman was like, you know, it was like a bunch of people. It was going to go away in a heartbeat. It was already bleeding at an accelerating rate. So it made the legal options available to the Fed different in the end. That's a simple explanation.
If I can just follow up. The nub of my question was, why did you rescue Bear Stearns? That is, what is the impulse for rescuing Bear Stearns? Not the power to rescue Bear Stearns.
It wasn't.
Same with Lehman.
For two reasons. One is because it was systemic and because it was an option for doing so. So if you needed both, okay? If it wasn't systemic, we would have been indifferent to it. If it was systemic but we had no option, we wouldn't have done it.
Can you give us a metric of systemic?
Yeah, what do you mean by systemic?
Systemic is, as you guys know, I'm sure better than anybody, nobody knows what's systemic. It's completely, you can't say it. No, but you can't say it. There's no objective standard of what's systemic.
Well, what specific things do you think would happen is really the question. What would happen if Bear Stearns had failed?
And
then we'll make this last follow-up so we can proceed.
There was a very high probability at that time that what you saw after Lehman would have happened after Bear. It was exactly because of that fear that led us to work hard. We just might have gotten there to try to figure out how to avoid that. Because I thought at that point we were already in the midst of pretty full-scale powerful run on the system, and we did not believe, you know, classic doctrine is let the guys fail, protect the innocent, you draw a fire break around the thing, you protect the solvent. So we did, you know, massive lending by the Federal Reserve against collateral, against the major non-bank counterparties in the system. Not powerful enough. And again, you saw that after Lehman. You saw even with a huge expansion of basic protections on funding for other institutions, you saw the entire system basically come undone because people started to price in the probability all other institutions would fail. But you're absolutely right. There's no objective standard for what's systemic. It's only a judgment you can make at the time. It's terribly vulnerable in retrospect, people looking at it and saying, gee, it turned out pretty well. How did you know it was systemic? Or could have been more damaging. You can't, no objective standard. You just have to look at broad measures of fee and risk premium. And again, you had, in the United States, you had people starting to take their deposits out of very, very strong banks. Long way removed, distance and risk and business from the guys on Wall Street that were at the epicenter of the problem. And that is a good measure. Classic measure of incipient panic.
All right. What's your schedule like at this point?
I got to go.
Okay. Let's do this. And a couple of things. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.